And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast on a rainy, blustery Wednesday evening in beautiful New York City. And one of the things that I want to do more this year is throw a few quickie episodes out there where I highlight the wonderful work of my colleagues. And I've ordered all of them by fiat, by governmental fiat, to tell me when they have something really good in the works. And Baxter Holmes obeyed the fiat last week with his mega piece on sleep, a subject I'm very passionate about. And then some other stuff happened that clouded my schedule a little bit, and I couldn't get to that. And then he disobeyed the fiat and dropped a huge piece on an issue that is going to be very interesting the whole year. It's like, what's happening with Carmelo Anthony? So I made him come on and talk about that. Baxter Holmes, how are you?
I'm doing well, man. How are you?
How's life in LA? It's probably sunny and 80 degrees there.
That sounds about right. So sorry about the rain.
People were so mad in New York when I admittedly had a conniption fit a few weeks ago on my own podcast when I just went on a rant about the Knicks and the word suck was used an amount of times that I'm actually embarrassed about. Really, I happened to be in Los Angeles and I was so jealous of the weather and so jealous that both teams are good. And like a wash of anger came over me. Because I just don't know when the Knicks are going to be good again, and I want them to be good. And so I apologize to the Knicks fans for using the word suck so many times. Here we are again talking about the weather and Carmelo Anthony and the Knicks. So Baxter Holmes, what other than the obvious made you want to do this story about what is happening with Carmelo Anthony? You begin the story with his last field goal attempt. Of course, he was unknowing that it would be his last field goal attempt with the Houston Rockets last year. And how long have you been sort of poking around at what happened in Houston and why has nobody signed him?
Yeah, this was a conversation I had with my editors over the summer of stories that I could sink my teeth into. And we were talking about Carmelo Anthony. And I was interested in part because certainly he had kind of transitioned into basketball exile, as I'd kind of written in a dramatic way after his 10-game departure, his departure after 10 games from Houston. And there was kind of a question of why, but I thought there were a lot of other themes there that were really interesting, such as the evolution of the game and the way it kind of evolved around Melo leaving him, quote unquote, on the wrong side of history. I thought about the concept of how stars, as they age and near the end, it's often, you know, quite ugly, and that fall from grace. And I thought about the dichotomy of certain guys he's really close with, such as like Dwayne Wade getting a farewell tour, and then Melo's just cast off after 10 games. And, you know, this wondering of him being in kind of a purgatory of sorts of, you know, whether is it all over? Is it not over? And I think there was an Atlantic magazine piece that came out at some point in recent weeks or months, and it talked about professional decline for people just in general. And how the end often comes before we're ready for it. And I was thinking about that concept with Melo. So, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of things that aligned there, not just the fact of a particular player, you know, and his end coming quickly and him being great, a future Hall of Famer. So I spent probably, I don't know, at various points like a month and a half digging around, trying to figure out what happened. And here we have it, the story that came out today. So.
The Rockets, it's clear you talked to a lot of people with the Rockets about what happened with Carmelo. And the weird, I just remember it being, is he sick? Have they told him they're going to waive him? What's actually happening? They seem both remorseful of almost of signing him in the first place. Like, we should have known it wasn't going to work. Shockingly surprised that he could not switch on defense and stay in front of people, which for them to be surprised by that is shocking. I say it's shocking. Like, Donovan Mitchell ended Carmelo Anthony's career. Maybe not. He may get a shot at some point this year, but may have ended Carmelo Anthony's career by just roasting him over and over again in the 2018 playoffs until the Thunder had to cry uncle and replace him with Jeremy Grant. And by the way, Utah is a team that just is sort of like congenitally opposed to playing that, let me just play one-on-one, hunt the weak guy and play one-on-one. And Donovan Mitchell was a rookie. It was like he had to prove that he was equipped to do that. And like, that's how bad it was. And for the Rockets to sign Carmelo and then be like, oh boy, this isn't working out defensively for us. He can't just switch on to like point guards, all of whom are awesome every night in the NBA, and like and hold his own. It seemed a little strange to me. Talk about like the process of getting the Rockets people to open up a little bit about Carmelo.
Well, the first thing was I was having dinner with a front office person who's not with the Rockets, and we were talking about Carmelo, and they brought up this point. They said, you know, everybody talks about how Carmelo's not in the league because he refuses to accept a role on offense and like coming off the bench. And you remember the scene in Oklahoma City where he said like, who me, about coming off the bench. And then he had stronger comments after that year.
After the year. By the way, it's 2019 right now. Those comments were in 2018 where he said, I'm not sacrificing no bench role. Dude, that was a year and change ago and he's out of the NBA.
Right. Yeah. And he said, and that's out of the question, in return to that, in reference to that comment.
Should probably be back into the question.
But so that was actually the thing that I, and so this front office person said, he's like, he cannot play defense in today's NBA. Like that's the other stuff about his offense is kind of a red herring. They said he's such a minus because of the way the defense is played. You have to play defense because of the way the game has evolved. And they brought up this particular, you know, as you mentioned, well, the Utah series against Oklahoma City. And they said, go back and watch the film. Every single time down the court, basically, the Jazz were targeting him. They played him off the court. There's that game where the Thunder are down by so much, and then they take him out of the game. Then they come back, and they said that was it. Like we couldn't, you know, so it's his inability to play defense is why he's out of the game. And it's really that simple. But yeah, to your point, I had a lot of questions about, well, why would the Rockets? You know, you think of them, this really analytically driven, meticulous organization. Why would they add a guy who it seemed like, you know, you didn't need much to look much further than that Utah Jazz series? Why would they add a guy like this, knowing that they play the most switch happy defense in the NBA? And the answers I got from certain people in and around the organization were, look, this is a gamble that we took. You know, we were confident in the system. We thought that we could accentuate the positives, minimize the negatives. And, you know, we've taken gambles before and they haven't worked out. This was obviously a very high profile one. We were hopeful that his offensive abilities could, you know, overcome his defensive weaknesses. But it was at their first training camp when there were started to be warning signs, as I'd written, that, wow, he is looking really slow and he can't move his feet and he's going to. So it kind of portended that it wasn't going to work out. And then those first 10 games were kind of a perfect storm of bad things happening, whether it was James Harden's injury, Chris Paul gets suspended. Melo actually had a couple good offensive games, but the Rockets are sliding down in the ever ultra competitive Western Conference, and they're just out of desperation, and especially comes off the heels of this horrible, what looks like final game for him in Oklahoma City, where it's like, we gotta make a change, you know, and that's that point. But there absolutely is, as you had referenced, this feeling of remorse of, you know, this is a Hall of Famer, and how this ultimately played out, and maybe our bad decision making ended his career. I talked to one person who said those 10 games basically ruined him, and there's definitely remorse and regret.
There was always this mythical being, Team USA Melo. Why can't he be Team USA Melo? And I actually think his time in Oklahoma City, he basically was. The first 15 or 20 games, when it was him and PG and Russ, there was a clear sort of learning curve where he was still a little bit of jab steppy Melo, a little bit of 20-footer Melo. And by the end, he became the player on offense that people wanted him to be. He didn't shoot it as well as people hoped, but he became that player. He became essentially a spot-up guy who, yeah, you know, when it was maybe he was alone without the other two stars or there was one star in him, he might do a little old-school Melo cooking here and there. But he became that guy. It was the defense that as you said, it was the defense that did him in. Like, he's been painted with this. Even now you hear from people in the NBA who have maybe watched him work out or thought about signing him, whatever, you will hear the talent is still there. There's no mm-hmm. question he's talented enough to play in the NBA. No question. But he just wants to play his way. He still wants to play. Watch him play pickup. He still wants to play his way. I don't buy that. And I don't think the time in Oklahoma City and Houston demonstrates that. Now, did he want to come off the bench? No. Did he say ridiculous things about coming off the bench? Yes. Do I think he probably would love to play old school jab steppy mellow cooking ball? Yeah, I do. But I don't think he was really playing that way in those stops.
Yeah, and something you'd said that I thought was interesting about Oklahoma City, and I don't think this made – I'm pretty sure this didn't make the piece, but somebody had pointed out to me that, you know, during that time when he was here, let's say they had Roberson, Paul George, and Steven Adams, so like three plus-plus defenders. And they said those guys could be on the court and together could help minimize the defensive weaknesses that he had, and he could be the plus. He could be the quote-unquote Olympic Melo the guys wanted. But I'd heard that, you know, it was like when Roberson went out, things started to change, and, you know, you couldn't hide his defensive weaknesses anymore. But the crux of that anecdote was it took three – in today's NBA, the way the style was played, it took three really good defensive players to be able to mask Carmelo's defensive weaknesses, which have – look, that's never been his strong suit. I mean, nobody has ever pretended it was. But they were speaking about that in today's day and age. It took like three guys on the court who were that good to help minimize the his weaknesses in that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. They already have a scheme designed to minimize the weaknesses of one of their defenders, and it's James Harden. And if you try to do that for both guys, the whole thing kind of falls apart. And James Harden, actually, much like Melo, the best thing he does defensively is defend the post. And Melo was always a pretty stout post defender with quick hands. He's hard to move around. Like, he could hold his own in the post against bigger guys. Harden is one of the very best in the league at it. The difference is all these switching defenses will attack Harden in the post, because if you put him on an island one-on-one, James Harden maybe doesn't want to play defense. Yeah, maybe he'll fall into a coma off the ball sometimes and give you a little YouTube defensive blooper. But you put him on an island on the ball, James Harden's still a guard. He's 6'6". He's fast. He's a guard. He can stay in front of guys. So by default, the best way to attack James Harden on the switch, or teams seem to think, is to post him up. And he can do that just fine. He can defend that just fine. Melo can't do the other thing. The thing he can't do is stay in front of people. So there is a way to attack him on switches that is actually efficient and not posting up for nothing, for low efficiency points. It's an interesting contrast. Before we get into other stuff, Melo didn't talk to you, and Melo's people didn't talk to you. So in my head, when I read something like that, I know Baxter Holmes. Baxter Holmes is trying to get Carmelo Anthony. Baxter Holmes is going through four or five different pathways to get Carmelo Anthony, because you never know which pathway is going to pay off. Who friend of a friend of a friend is like, no, this guy Baxter is a good guy. You should talk to him. Baxter Holmes may be camping outside the Hell's Kitchen gym where Carmelo Anthony – I don't even think it's Hell's Kitchen. Whatever 11th Avenue is in New York now, where they have the spaceship-looking buildings – Baxter Holmes might be sleeping out there in a tent for 4 days, foraging for food, waiting to ambush Carmelo Anthony as he's coming out of the gym. So how close did you get to getting Melo to talk to you? Did you actually talk to him in person and have him say, hey, man, I can't talk to you?
No, I didn't. I wasn't able to get to him in front of him. I did go through a lot of different avenues and – you know, was rebuked at every turn. And then I went back down those same avenues as the story was progressing. There were talks. Yeah, there were a lot of talks. There was hope. Certainly on my end, I appreciate the efforts you described, the lengths I'll go to try to get an interview or whatnot. But yeah, it didn't happen. And I think, it says somewhere in the piece that, I think he and his team are deeply wary of information being out there that could potentially harm his ability to come back to the NBA. You know, my personal take on that is I don't know what could come out necessarily. I mean, I suppose something could, but that would lead to him not being the NBA if he's not already in. You know, I think if he was going to sign with a team with the season starting a week from now, he probably already would have by this point. That's not to say, obviously, that he won't by any point in the season. I think most of it's just on the court, you know. The number of people who I talk to around the league have – and this isn't an ending I'm sure he wants. And this is something that somebody said to me, it didn't make the piece, but they said the whole issue here is, you know, people would like to say that they could be able to go out on their own terms, not just in basketball but in any walk of life. And that's often not the case. We all don't get the farewell tour.
Well, it's something of a bit of poetry. Carmelo is 22nd all-time in scoring NBA and ABA mixed together, because you're damn right I put the ABA in. The ABA points count. When I do my all-time leaders thing, you throw in the ABA. You don't separate it. He's 22nd all-time. 25,551 points. That is a hell of a lot of points. By the way, I'm glad that the is Carmelo a Hall of Famer debate has kind of fit. Yes, Carmelo Anthony's making the Hall of Fame. People who have 25,000 points in whatever All-Star appearances he has, and most of them were in the West, or a good portion of them were in the West, which are like real All-Star appearances. He's in. It's over. Forget it. Right behind him and going to pass him soon with 25,430 points, so 121 points behind Carmelo Anthony, is Vince Carter. And the poetry in that is obvious, right? It's that one of them, mid-career, embraced and figured out, okay, I'm not Vince Carter anymore. How can I help a team? And way almost ahead of schedule was not like – there was no, I don't remember reading stories about, now there were unflattering stories about Vince early in his career and bailing out on Toronto and all that, but I don't remember reading stories about, oh, there's really a lot of tussling behind the scenes and Vince is fighting back and wants to be old Vince. Like Vince sort of smoothly, almost to the degree you didn't notice, became a role player and, I think took extreme steps off the floor to take care of his body, to install routines in his life for game days that he strictly goes by. Like, you can't have Vince Carter on a podcast on a game day. I've tried. He won't do it because he is so religious about his naps and all that. We could talk about naps if you want. You have put the kibosh on naps in your other story. Naps are bad now. I feel like my father, who's like, you listen to these scientists and 20 years coffee's good and then coffee's bad. Now naps are bad. I thought naps were good. Anyway, there are people in the league who think there is a chance that mid-season, a team that's got some injuries and some roster spots is going to give Melo a look. And I can't decide if I wonder if that team is Cleveland or Charlotte or a team like that. If Carmelo is going to think to himself, well, I'm still Carmelo Anthony. Like, I want a big stage. I want a big stage and I want a winning team. Did you get any insight into would he – like Vince Carter plays for the Hawks. You know what I mean? Would he ever go to a team like that just to get back in the league?
I've heard some people who I've talked to made mention of that, just that he wants closure. He wants a different ending. He doesn't want those 10 games in Houston and the way everything ended to be the final chapter and, you know, the last thing kind of tasting people's mouths when they think about him and the end of his career. Anything could happen, I guess. I mean, as you pointed out, whether it's injuries or somebody needs something, it obviously have to be the right fit. I'll be honest in that the more days go by, I have talked to people who've said that he's at peace with things right now. As he said on air with Stephen A. Smith, and that, you know, this point in time has allowed him to become closer with his family and his young son. And he didn't, obviously during the NBA season for a lot of his time, he wasn't able to really do that. And that he'd certainly love to come back, but he also understands that there are a lot of things outside his control. And if this is the end, then, that's outside of his control as well. And to just kind of move on in a way, but I do believe what some people have told me about him kind of, you know, wanting closure in a way. I mean, as a human being, it'd be hard to imagine him not wanting it, quite frankly.
I think it would be kind of cool to see Melo play again because this is all relevant almost by accident this week. The Chicago Sun-Times ran a very cranky anti-analytics article. I think there was even a joke about calculator. There was a calculators and maybe pocket protectors. I can't remember. It was one. We were like one away from the bingo where mom's basement gets invoked. But it was about how the analytics department in Chicago, as if they have like 15 number crunchers on computers talking about formulas and pie graphs and all this, don't want Zach LaVine shooting mid-range jumpers or would prefer Zach LaVine not shoot as many mid-range jumpers, and how this was bad because we are stamping the beautiful mid-range shot out of basketball. And of course, there is some truth to the fact that the mid-range shot is less frequent than it used to be and has been replaced by other sorts of shots that count for more points. But this was a lament. And whenever you hear the lamenting of the death of the mid-range game, Carmelo is one of the guys that comes up. And when Melo was on, it was just beautiful. It was a thing, like, it's undeniable. We'll talk about some of his sort of career highlights later, but when he was on, it was undeniable. But I find it interesting that this, this debate continues to go on, and like this lamenting continues to go on. And I'm sorry, but, a lot of Zach LaVine's long twos are really bad shots. If you take a pull up two early in the shot clock, here's what Zach LaVine shot in his career on long twos. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm. Let's do it.
38% last year. 26%. Now, that's his ACL comeback year. Let's throw that out. Let's be nice to Zach LaVine and throw that out. 41%. That's his career high, 2016-17. 35%, 35%. Those are just bad shots because you don't get fouled. You don't get offensive rebounds. I'm sorry that three is so much more than two, that the math has dictated that those shots are bad and should be replaced by shots that are worth 3 points. You have to be so efficient taking mid-range twos to take the volume of them that we're talking about someone like Carmelo Anthony taking. And so I'm sorry, Zach LaVine, but your coach is right. You shouldn't be taking a lot of those shots. Now, late clock, fourth quarter, playoff games against the best defenses who are going to take out a lot of the stuff, and you're not going to get nice little open corner threes for Lowry Markkanen, et cetera, et cetera. You're damn right you need that in your arsenal, but overall, you should probably take it out.
The thing that you're talking about, it reminds me that a lot of this discussion feels like there's almost a sense of nostalgia of the way the game used to be played, which can quickly turn into kind of, you know, cranky back in my day talk. But, you know, with respect to Carmelo, there's the thing that I thought about a lot as I've kind of ruminated over his, you know, demise, I guess, in the game, is he came up playing a certain style that made the people that was very successful, made some of the people he idolized before him. Certainly, you know, Jordan shot his more than his fair share of mid-range, Allen Iverson, Kobe, guys like that. But as his career progressed, there was this, you know, great kind of evolution or revolution of understanding efficiency more. And we started to understand that there were, you know, way better approaches, or more efficient approaches, I should say, to the game. And so it happened in the middle of his career. But he came up playing a certain style that, and it did make him special. Like, as you pointed out, when he was on, man, it was special to see. I remember some of it when I was covering the Celtics for the Boston Globe during that season where he led the NBA in scoring, and going to the Garden and having him come up to Boston and seeing him, you know, light the Nets on fire. Like, it was really special. But the game changed and around him, and it kind of put him on an island, so to speak, and rendered him obsolete, I think, if I'm saying that right. And but again, I think that there's nostalgia. Like, he came up playing a certain way. It's what made his idol special. It's what ultimately made him special. And that thing that was special because of our understanding of basketball just went away. And that's, you know, the game is different now.
He's an interesting contrast with Dirk, who actually, by sheer volume, took a higher percentage of his shots for his career from 16 feet to the three-point line, the dreaded long twos. He just shot them way better. Hmm. Dirk is, for his career, including the end of his career when he slumped a little bit, is 47% on long twos.
Oof.
That's, now, he's obviously taller, and that helps him in a lot of different ways, which we'll talk about, but that Carmelo is 41%. Now, you might say that's just 6 percentage points. That's 6 shots out of 100. Is that really that big of a difference? In the way that defenses rotate to you, the urgency with which they rotate to you, yes, it is that big of a difference. Dirk, also being 7 feet tall, was very often a screen setter, and his long twos originated in a different, more team-oriented context. So Dirk sets a screen. If there is no switch, he's popping out for a jumper. There are two people rotating to him. Other people are open. That's a different kind of two-point jumper. Dirk sets a screen, gets a switch, sets up shop at the foul line. That becomes a little similar to Melo's jab-stepping game, but it's also different. And he's just a better shooter, just a flat better shooter. Carmelo Anthony on the right wing jab stepping 14 times stops the offense. It doesn't come within the flow of the offense. The other guys are not involved. They're stationary targets, which if you're as efficient as James Harden, that's fine. That's what the Rockets render their guys. But, and Carmelo at his best could draw a ton of help in that circumstance by driving, by backing down, by whatever, but he didn't always draw a ton of help fading for 20 footers. And, one of the ways in which he's different from, say, Tracy McGrady, he was never quite that good of a passer in those situations. He's a 3-4 assists a game guy. Some of his best passing came out of the post, and we'll talk about that 2013 Knicks team where he was a monster from the post. But from the triple threat position, one of the three threats was not quite as good as it needed to be for that to be that efficient of a two. And it's not the Dirk twos are just a little different.
And the point that you made, I think, with respect to Dirk and Melo that I think about is just, you know, the way that the ball stopping, you know, even though Dirk was taking those kinds of shots, I'm sure you'd have numbers to back this up. It never felt the way that the ball was stopping or that it was really heavy ISO in the way that, it was for Melo. So yeah, different styles of play, even though their shots might have been coming from the same area and obviously different, you know, style shooters in terms of their accuracy.
And by the way, none of this is to minimize Carmelo Anthony. He walked into the league a star. Remember LeBron? LeBron attended his playoff games. LeBron's team didn't make the playoffs when he was a rookie, and Carmelo's did. LeBron would go to games and watch Carmelo. He walks into the league a star. And he's on the star-crossed George Karl Denver teams that lose in the first round every year, but rarely are they favorites, which is a less sexy thing to say, but was true. You know, and you can, I don't know what favorite memories you have of Melo, but you know, the 2009 run with the Nuggets, it came very close to making the finals. I mean, he was just an absolute monster. That's the year they beat the Hornets, the New Orleans Hornets, by 58 points in a first round game. His last two games against Dallas in the second round of the playoffs, he goes for 41 in a loss and then 30 on 13 of 22 shooting in the win. And then against the Lakers, now they lost that series. Mm-hmm. Carmelo has a 3 of 16 game in game 4 and a 4 of 13 game in game 3, which are not great, and then a 6 of 17 game in the closer. He also had a 14 of 20 game in game 1. I just remember the free throws and the physicality that he played with, and that the Lakers just had no answer for his physicality. And if you look, he's at the line 14 times, 14 times, 11 times, 13 times, 15 times. Mm-hmm. I went back and looked it up. I just remember watching those games just as a freelance basketball writer then and being like, they just can't do anything with this dude. He's too strong.
One thing that, again, this guy left on the cutting room floor, but I had heard from a teammate of Carmelo's that he is particularly haunted by that Western Conference final series against the Lakers. And I believe in two of those games, there were crucial inbounds passes late that were stolen. And
Trevor Ariza.
Trevor Ariza, and there might be one other one, but somebody had told me specifically that he is haunted by those inbounds passes because he now looks back, I'm told, and realizes that was his last best chance to win a championship, and that he was in his prime then and what it would have meant for his legacy and whatnot. And that goes to speak of just how, you know, you've talked about this a lot, like the smallest little things. A sprained ankle here, can end up coming back to haunt people because as they look back and they feel it that that's how close they were and maybe as close as they were ever going to get.
I also just remember just one of the more innocuous Carmelo playoff series, Knicks Celtics in 2011. Knicks get swept. They lose the first game in Boston. I want to say it was a 2-7 series. It was a series that the Knicks should have lost. Knicks lose game 1 in Boston by 2. They lose game 2 in Boston by 3. Melo has 42 points, 17 rebounds, 6 assists, 10 made free throws. And I remember watching that game and thinking he's going to score every time, even though he's only 14 of 30, but with the 10 free throws, it's much better than that. he just had this feeling of like, he's going to score every single time. The Celtics can't do anything with him. And that was the game where Jerry Jeffries famously fumbles the ball out of bounds when he has a layup staring him in the face, either tie or take the lead. I don't remember. It was an embarrassing blooper for Jerry Jeffries. And you just saw that they almost had that at 1-1 and then the Knicks fell apart at home. But sports is as analytical as sports gets. It's still about, feeling. It's still about feeling. And Melo would make you, when he would go on a streak of just implausible mid-range shots and just like those streaks where you just can't, he's too strong. He was great at rebounding his own misses. He's one of the best ever at rebounding his own misses, like just bullying to the rim and missing a layup but getting his own rebound. There were times where you just would look at him and think, there is nothing anybody can do with this guy. And the math never worked out to kind of match the style of it. I think Melo is a very stylish player. Sometimes I almost thought he was self-consciously stylish. Like he likes the jab step. He'll do the thing on defense where he'll get a rebound. And sometimes if he gets it in midair, he'll whap the ball against the backboard and kind of show off a little bit. He likes to swipe on defense. Swipe it though. He's very good at like sideways swiping shot blocks, which are A, an alternative to actually trying to move your feet, but B, kind of stylish. He always struck me as a subconsciously stylish player, but man, was he ever stylish.
He was. All those things, it's funny, even as you're talking about them, it's like, yeah, I don't really see that anymore, you know, but they were parts of his game. And, I mean, when he was on, so my first, full-time NBA beat reporting job was at the Boston Globe, and I started in the 2012-2013 season, so like midway through. And this is Doc is there, KG and Paul are there. This is before they get shipped to Brooklyn in the offseason, and they played the Knicks in the first round. And I recounted, you know, that season for Carmelo because a front office person had talked to me. We were kind of talking about the arc of Melo's career, and they're saying, you know, I wonder what happened with that. Like that 1 year, like the team was great, and Melo led the league in scoring, and they were bombing away from three-point range, and he was playing his rightful position. And I always just wonder, like, what happened? Because it was a precipitous decline from that point on.
I think every Knicks fan wonders what happened.
Yeah. But the thing I do remember was, like, watching that playoff series. I kind of think about this now in a funny way because he was great all that series. He was great all that season. I just remember, you know, I didn't know that that was going to be, like, not only the – you know, maybe the height of his powers and he would decline from then on, or that it would be the last time, you know, that you'd see the Knicks win a playoff series since then, that they wouldn't win another one or even be in the playoffs. But yeah, they, and so I, you know, in the story, kind of looking back, I was like, when was the last time Melo was Melo? That was my thought after, you know, talking to some people. And so I focused on this season and how it kind of came together. And as you said, it was a funny thing of, in part, you know, Amari Stoudemire suffers, has injury trouble all year, and it kind of forces Melo to play the stretch four position, which I was told he did not want to do. He didn't want to play power forward, and they had a bunch of shooters around
him.
That's
what I mean, though, by subconsciously stylish. That's part of it. He's a three. In his mind, he's a three because mm-hmm. threes face the basket and do cool stuff with the ball, and fours don't do that. And stretch fours sure as hell don't do that.
Yeah, and even one of his close friends was like, he's always been a stretch forward. He just doesn't accept it and kind of refuses to believe it. So this speaks to the kind of stylish thing. But that season, you know, he was forced to play it because of injury, and everything kind of magically fell into place. You know, people told me that all he had to do was score. He didn't have to worry about defense. They had Tyson Chandler around the middle to help clean things up. It was a really veteran group.
Well, and Chandler, I believe he had a pinched nerve in that conference semifinals against Indiana. And it is one of the what now Indiana took some injuries in that series. I think George Hill missed a game with a concussion, but that Tyson Chandler injury, like Roy Hibbert just demolished him in that series. It's a what if, and not that team was going to win the championship, but it's the further you get, the more special the season is.
Yeah. And to that point, the thing I thought was kind of ironic in a way was you talk about the styles of the game changing. I mean, if you were to say at that point that Roy Hibbert would be out of the league, you know, or that he would become this really steep, precipitous decline from that playoff series or, you know, soon after. I don't think people would have believed it then. But, you know, centers were the changing of the game affected them too. And Roy Hibbert was, you know, once one of the most dominant defensive big men in the game, if not the most. And then all of a sudden he's out of the league. So, yeah, I mean, but it was kind of an interesting playoff series, I think. And then, as quickly as all that you know, great season was for Melo and the Knicks as it came together, it fell apart. And it's the decline every year up until, as I said, exile at this point.
I want to go back to the mid-range thing first for a second, because there are a couple of things that there are the mid-range shot. Seth Partnow, who now is at the Athletic, used to work for the Bucks, wrote a great piece about this recently. Yes, the mid-range shot is quote unquote dying in terms of sheer volume, but his point is what's really happened to it is that players who aren't very good at it aren't allowed to take it anymore. The super duper stars whose job it is to create something from nothing late in games and who are actually good at that shot, they're still taking it in relatively high or similar volume as they were 10, 15 years ago. Like Jimmy Butler with the Sixers last year, that was part of his job. Late in games, our point guard can't shoot, refuses to shoot. Our other best offensive player is a big guy. It's hard to play through him. Please get us some 18 footers off the dribble. Kawhi Leonard is amazing at it. That stuff is not going away. It's the players who aren't quite as good at it. That's being phased out of the game. The other point is Kurt Goldsberry's book was about this. If you really want to bring it back in style, if you want to bring the post up back in style as a vehicle for scoring and not drawing help and passing, which is what Melo was doing in that one magical New York season, if you want to bring back the jab steps and all that, you're just going to have to change the rules. And Kirk has a lot of proposals for this. You can listen to a podcast that I did with him. Some of it is just officiating. Some of it is spacing the court differently or eliminating the corner three, whatever. But you're just going to have to change the rules because the math is overwhelming. Threes are better than most of the shots you're talking about. And teams are in the business of winning. Teams are in the business of better. And the math just is what it is. And the math isn't changing unless the league manipulates the rules to change the math.
No, I mean, that's all well said, and I feel like I see it more in the playoffs. You know, you mentioned Kawhi. I think of Kyrie Irving, you know, some of these big stars, you know, late in the game when they're trying to make something out of nothing, the mid-range is where they're going, but they are experts at doing this. So the guys who can still do it obviously do it at a really high level, and especially at those key moments. But, yeah, there's this perception that the mid-range is dead. I feel like it's just becoming more specialized in a way.
Let's talk about that Knicks team. Because if I had to boil down that Knicks team in my head to one image, aside from Carmelo Anthony on the right elbow extended, it's Carmelo Anthony in the post on the left block. It's Carmelo Anthony either facing up a four who's too slow for him, or if he gets the other matchup, a three who's not as big as him, going into the post, going to work, back to the basket, help comes, and it was like one of the closest regular things to what Olajuwon looked like, not in terms of impact or efficiency, but just in how simple he made the game. Help comes, swing, 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 and that was when the Knicks had multiple point guards on the floor at lots of times, Jason Kidd, Prigioni, Felton, and tons of shooting because Melo was playing the four, and he would draw help and they would just like zip the ball around and shoot tons of threes. I believe they may have set the record at the time or challenged an Olajuwon team's record actually for highest team 3-point rate. And it was so lethally efficient and simple. And I wonder looking back on it, if like the passing, the reads were simple. And if you simplified it, Melo became a better passer. He like making the more complicated reads that LeBron makes and other super duper stars make from sort of attacking positions that aren't post ups and stuff on the fly were a little harder for him. And like there and that year also, Melo ran a decent amount of pick and roll and he was good at it. Like he was pretty good at it. And again, when the reads got complicated, he wasn't as good as some of his superstar peers, but he was really good. And you would watch him do these things. And you would say, why doesn't he do that more? There's such a wonderful all-around player in here. He's like a really good pick-and-roll player. He can shoot off the dribble. He can see over the defense. He can make the pass to the corner. He's a decent passer. Why doesn't he do it more? And it's almost like he fought against being that kind of player so much, except that one year, because of the position, because of the team they had around him, the game was right and simple and easy for him, and it was just devastating.
Yeah. And, you know, I talked to members, in and around the organization and they had described, you know, for that Knicks team, and they had described long wanting him to play like that stretch four position. And there just being this kind of fight, not only with Melo, but even members of ownership about not being willing to do that. And that he was a three, he was going to be a three, but then the injuries to Amari forced him into that position. And yeah, there's Steve Novak was bombing away from long range. You had, J.R. Smith as well. You had savvy guys, you know, Felton, Prigioni, Jason Kidd, Chandler could handle things in the middle, as I said. It all aligned, and it was a style that people in the organization had hoped would in some ways convince Melo, this is who you are. If you play this way, you see the kind of success we can have. Like, this was your natural position. And even people years later, at other stops and around the league, they would say like that was his natural position, but there was this fight, you know, with him to get to kind of accept that. It wasn't, you know, if they looked at that time and how he played and that style and how the team was built as being kind of a round peg into a round hole, that he didn't view it that way. And it was meant, you know, that he was meant to play a different style. And, so yeah, there's a sense of longing and what could have been. And this was perfect. And it should have been proof that this is the way it needs to be moving forward. And it just wasn't. But for one magical season, you know, it looked great. I remember seeing a lot of those games and, man, he was, I mean, even as you mentioned him on the block, like it's coming back to me and I'm seeing him spin and turn and his quick feet and, you know, when the help would come, being able to kick it out to JR and Steve Novak and the garden being, you know, Madison Square Garden coming alive. And it was something special. I mean, I certainly didn't think at the time that there was such an aggressively ticking clock on it. Or that there would be on him ultimately as a player from that point on, but you know, that's basketball.
It's interesting. You have a coach, I think it's a coach quoted in your story, saying it's never easy for top 10 players. They still think they're top 10 players. And it got me thinking, and if I had more time, or when I do have more time, I'd like to go back year by year and think, I wonder how many seasons in which he really was one of the 10 best players in the league. He made all NBA six times. Four of them were third team. Two of them were second team, never made a first team All-NBA. And I remember one of my most vivid memories from when I just started doing this full time, Sports Illustrated had me do the top 100 players in the NBA, or I actually made the mistake of pitching that idea because holy cow, was that a laborious thing. I mean, it was fun, but I fretted, and now they still do it. Rob Mahoney does a wonderful job with it now. And I think I had Melo 18th or something, 19th maybe. This was 2011, so this is a prime Melo. And now I think that was probably low, and back then I fetishized defense to I probably overdid it, fetishizing defense. I probably weighed that side of the ball almost too much in evaluating players. Now I think there are some people who weigh it too little in evaluating players. I think the way the Clippers have built their team suggests that they weigh it maybe more than a lot of other teams do in crafting their idea of what a superstar is. But let's just say I fetishized it a little bit. I was too far the other way. And then we got the opportunity to sit down with Melo, and not about this, about he was promoting something. I said, you want to do it? I said, sure. And I'm in a room with Carmelo Anthony. I'm like, well, I got to ask him. I know he saw it. I got to ask him. I said, you know, I did the top 100. I think I ranked you 19th or something like that. And he just looked at me and said, there ain't 18 players better than me in the NBA. No way. But I do wonder, when you consider how bad he was defensively, and he's never been good, if he really, really ever was one of the top 10 players in the NBA, I bet we could find a season or two where he probably was. But and he has an MVP. He finished third in MVP the next year, sixth, 1 year for the Nuggets. And those are his only top 10 MVP finishes. I bet there are a couple years where you could make the argument.
Man, it's a really amazing interaction with him. And it was
great. He was great. By the way, he was a good sport. He smiled. He laughed. He said, there ain't 18 more players better than me. Who are some of the names you had ahead of me? No, not him. He was great. And people love Carmelo. Love him. Now, that's not to say he hasn't had some ugliness in some of his stops with Mike D'Antoni or Jeremy Lin or whatever. But, like, coaches, I don't know what sense you got. But, like, he is a personality people gravitate toward.
Oh, yeah. Look, one of the consistent things I heard from every organization that he played in was people would say he was great. He was a professional. Like, guys really enjoy being around him. His work ethic was awesome. He wasn't a locker room problem. There weren't issues off the court. people would praise all of these other things, but they would just say, you know, on the court, like defensively, he's become a liability. And, you know, one thing that I was thinking of too, you know, that's not to say that there aren't guys in the NBA who are like really good scorers, but are not, you know, excellent on the defensive end or even, you know, great. I mean, you know, one guy we look at is Lou Williams. But he gives you so much, offensively. And I had some people reference that to me. They would say, Carmelo does not give you enough offensively today to be able to justify what he's going to cost you when he's on the defensive end of the court. And if you want to boil it down to a really simple reason as to why we can't put him in the game, that's it. You know, yes, the style of play has changed. There's all these other things, but he will cost you more than he will give you. And so if you want to look at the basic math of productivity, it's just not there. But the complicated thing is he's a Hall of Famer. He's a star. He comes with all this cachet. And, you know, as someone had said in the piece, you know, his name is a blessing and a curse. And it's more of a curse right now because it makes it difficult. Every, you know, if he goes to any team and he doesn't play, then the coaches are like, why isn't he playing? Why did you bring him here? And there's just, you know, there'll
You nailed it. One of the hesitations around the league has been he's a story. Every day he's a story. How much is he playing? Why did you sign him? Does he want to be here? Why isn't he playing more? Well, how did he play? Is his defense that bad? And like, maybe you ride it out for 10 or 15 games and he just becomes a guy on your team and it's not weird anymore. But that is absolutely a concern that he's a story and teams only have so much bandwidth and appetite for stuff that is a story every single day. And if you're going to be a story every single day, just by virtue of being you, you probably have to be a star.
Yeah. And he's not a star at this point. So you can't, you know, it's hard for people to justify. But yeah, I heard the same thing that you heard. And just, that goes back to the name being a blessing and a curse. And so I'll be interested to see what happens throughout the course of the season. It's hard. It's, you know, I opened the story talking about his final shot, which may well be the final shot of his career being a corner three pointer. And I've thought about that just, you know, when he walked off the court, when he checked out of the game soon after, I'm sure he never thought that it was over. And, you know, there's few people, as I go back to that one term that a coach gave me, you know, few people are ever really think it's over when it's over. You always can think there's more. And it's even harder for stars when you're on this Mount Olympus of dominance and stature and celebrity and things coming easy to you and you're just the best. You're used to all of it. Coming down from that is such a steep, steep fall. And it's why I think, you know, Dwayne even talked about that. Dwayne Wade talked about that, I think before a game, in what was Carmelo's last season or this past season, I should say, just like the toughest thing for GMs, presidents, owners, and players is how to handle an aging superstar. And I think that's such a complicated thing, in probably every sport, but it plays out for these guys on a public stage. It's not like they get to age behind the scenes in some corporate job where they're in an office or a cubicle and maybe the outside doesn't world. Doesn't
no, you
see
age
much.
On, yeah. You age on the banana boat right in front of the whole world.
Exactly. Yeah. So everyone sees your warts and how you're not as quick as you used to be. And, you know, somebody said to me at one point, we look at stars in such an interesting way too, because we look at them physically. We just, without seeing them move, and we kind of just think about what they could be able to do. We think of all the memories and the greatness that they gave us, the greatness that they had, how dominant they were. And we kind of can't square with time doing to them what it ultimately does to us all. You know, it takes away who we are in some ways. It diminishes our abilities. And we want our superstars to kind of be forever and to be frozen in that point in time when we first fell in love with them. And they age and, you know, it disappears. And we always have a hard reckoning with that. And I think there, in some ways, the problem with what happens to superstars, the problem with what happened to Carmelo, is that we want them to be forever and we want this to always last. And it just doesn't. You know, they're not always going to be the great player and as dominant as we wanted them when we fell in love with them. It's just nothing is forever.
Anything else left on the cutting room floor? Any good behind the scenes stories we haven't gotten to? Anything like that?
You know, I do think that the point that was made at the end of the story, and I've heard this from some people close to him, of him looking at guys like Dwayne Wade and having a farewell tour, Kobe, who he's close with having one, he knows LeBron will probably have one. And he's kind of the odd man out in a way of, you know, the group that he loves and believes in, he won't, you know, he's likely not going to get that, almost certainly not going to get that. And so this lingering feeling of closure, I think, is going to be with him. But, you know, as somebody said to me once, that's what life is. It's a cold slap in the face.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see if we see him again. You know, you almost are not sure if you want to see him. Oh, well, Camarillo, it's great to watch him make some jump shots in a March game for Team X going nowhere, but it would still be kind of cool to see Carmelo make a few more jump shots. All right, Baxter Holmes, the story is on ESPN all day today. It'll be there all day tomorrow. It's a wonderful look at Carmelo Anthony. This sort of just, you know, hey, what's going on? And you did very well on it. I enjoyed it very much. So thank you, as always, for your time, my friend.
Thank you for having me, man. I appreciate it.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.